The court will now call the case of U.S. v. Hayes. Government, are you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon. Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kevin Shea, and I represent the United States.
Can I just ask in the back, can you hear okay? All right, thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
With your permission, I'd like to request 2 minutes' time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Counsel, I am having trouble hearing. I don't know quite what you can do, but, yeah.
Your Honor, this court should reverse the lower court and affirm the convictions for three reasons. Number one, considered in context of the entire record, appellant's unsworn statement did not raise substantial conflict with his plea. Number two, the evidence in this case fails to establish several elements of the duress defense, and as a result, at most, the mere possibility of a defense was raised. And number three, suicide cannot, as a matter of law, be the threat necessary to give rise to duress. The lower court erred because it failed to apply the required contextual analysis that this court has laid out. And in doing so, it viewed Midshipman Hayes' unsworn statement and pre-sentencing evidence in a vacuum. It speculated post-trial as to facts that were not in the record. Under the proper contextual analysis, in light of the entire record, the facts...
Let me ask you a threshold question. Is an unsworn statement... We know an unsworn statement's not evidence. Is the content of an unsworn statement sufficient, other things being equal, to raise the possibility of a defense if it's limited to the unsworn statement?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor. However, okay. In Shaw, this court has indicated that it should be given, to some degree, less weight, obviously, than sworn evidence because the factual record is not developed, so you're less likely to have conflict with the record.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The facts in this case, under the required contextual analysis, with the lower court failed to consider. In this case, the appellant, or the appellee, excuse me, had $30,000 deposited into his bank account on October 1st of 2008. He did not begin to steal these items until October 3rd. Additionally, in the stipulation of fact, he agreed that no one forced or coerced him to commit these offenses. During the plea colloquy, the appellant, the appellee, on 21 occasions, assured the military judge that nobody forced him or coerced him to commit these offenses. In his NCIS statement, he told the investigators in a sworn statement that he only gave his mother most of the money. Additionally, he acknowledged that he could have gotten a second job had he so desired. The bank records that were introduced before the military judge as evidence in aggravation indicate that he spent thousands of dollars on vacations and jewelry.
The government has certified three issues in this case. First goes toward the elements of the defense. The second goes toward your theory that a mere possibility should not be used to undermine a plea, but you're looking for a prima facie case of some sort. And then your third is whether suicide can ever stand as a basis for a duress defense. Which is the theory upon which you would hope this court would resolve this case?
Your Honor, I think our best argument is that even under assuming that suicide can in fact be the threat necessary and that couldn't satisfy that element of duress, that even under the current contextual analysis, there wasn't sufficient evidence raised to raise substantial conflict with the plea. So even under the existing framework, assuming that suicide can be the threat necessary, it didn't raise substantial conflict with the plea. So basically one and two, Your Honor.
Now, the government certified the third issue of suicide. What is the government's interest in having that question of law resolved?
Yes, Your Honor. This court declined to directly answer, both in Rankins and in Ollinger, whether or not the threat could be from a third party, or be from just a third party, or from other sources as well. And this would be an opportunity for the court to clarify that. And we believe that the language in Washington, that the threat...
Does the government have a legal policy or policy reason why it would prefer one outcome or the other? You've said it'd be good to clarify it, but why not clarify it the other way?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd answer that in two parts. Number one, duress, classically, as this court has indicated, even in Rockwood, indicates and implies that there's a third party involved. There's a threat against either the defendant himself or another person, a third person. Additionally, relying on the language in Washington, the threat must emanate from an unlawful threat. If suicide is not...
Right, now that's not quite my question. You're giving me the reasons why it might come out one way or the other, but I'm asking you, why does the government care how it comes out? What is the government's interest in having suicide included as a possible duress defense or excluded as a possible defense of duress?
It would be consistent with RCM 916. It would be consistent with the law. It's our interest in applying the law as it's written and the case law that's been laid out. And we believe that consistent with the case law and the RCM, that suicide would not qualify as a threat necessary.
Should the government care or take note, or should this court care or take note of the 2010 report regarding suicide in the armed forces, and why should or should not that influence us on the third certified question?
Your Honor, no, I don't think it should influence this court's determination on the third question.
Are you familiar with that report?
I am, yes, Your Honor. It's not a
policy. Counsel?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Is it part of the record?
I don't believe it is.
I'm still asking my question.
If you could please repeat the question, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Should the military's concerns about suicide, as reflected in that report or anywhere else, inform the government's position on whether suicide should or should not be part of a duress possibility?
No, Your Honor.
It's a legal policy question. It's not a case-specific question.
Yes, Your Honor. Our argument is not rooted in policy.
So to
the extent that policy is relevant, we think it would apply as extenuation and mitigation. We don't think it should inform this court's decision regarding whether or not legally it can qualify for the threat necessary to give rise to duress. As stated, even assuming this court finds suicide can be a threat necessary, under the facts of this case, there is not substantial conflict with the plea. And the reason the lower court erred is that because it failed to apply that required contextual analysis. This court has held and applied that contextual analysis in Riddle, in Shaw, in Philippe, Olinger, and Garcia. And those last three cases, Philippe, Olinger, and Garcia, that leads into our argument regarding the prima facie case that must be raised. Understanding U.S. v. Lee is still good law, I know the appellee attempts to argue that our brief insinuates that that must be overturned in order for us to win, and he's mistaken. With the evidence taken at face value, considering the context of the record, the lower court should not set aside a conviction unless there is truly substantial conflict with the plea.
What's the difference between mere possibility of a conflict and possibility of a conflict?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a good question. And as the appellee lays out, those two distinctions, there are clearly two standards. Mere possibility would not raise conflict. The possible defense, however, would. We're not asking you to set aside or disturb those two standards. We are, however, asking you to enlighten what those two standards mean. So in our position, Your Honor, the difference would be that the mere possibility of defense, considered in light most favorable or taken at face value, does not, even with that said, does not establish a prima facie case for each element of a given defense.
Are we reviewing the judge's inaction and not pursuing this defense, or are we reviewing the findings of the Court of Criminal Appeals and reversing the judge?
Well, I think in this particular case, Your Honor, you are looking at what the lower court's decision was. Ultimately, you should review the...
Don't they have fact-finding powers unusual to an appeals court that they could say, we believe this raised the defense. These facts, as meager as they may appear to you and me, raise a defense.
Your Honor, respectfully, to the extent that they take those facts and use them as grounds for a possible defense, we believe those would be legal conclusions, which this court is not bound by. The lower court's fact-finding authority, while unique, I believe pertains to a contested-type case and not in the guilty plea context. But addressing whether or not you're reviewing the military judge's findings, the military judge's decision to accept the plea obviously is reviewed for an abuse of discretion.
Where would we be if they had gone the next step and just say, based on this record, we're not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt and enter not guilty? Could we have reviewed that?
I believe you could have, Your Honor. Had they used, I guess, their plenary and awesome powers under Article 66C, potentially not. But if they found that there was a legal issue which was required to set aside the plea, I believe this court could, in fact, review it.
Then that throw us back to Judge Baker's question, as was their view of the law of suicide correct, and whether suicide could ever be provide the impetus for a person acting unlawfully.
Yes,
to be the catalyst.
In our view, their interpretation was incorrect, and not only that, but it was actually inconsistent with their prior published precedent from 2005 in Barnes. In 1993 as well. The Army Court of Military Review also found that suicide could not be the threat necessary. By no means is this argument unprecedented. The lower court erred for a variety of reasons. But again, even assuming that suicide could in fact be the threat necessary, if you look at the facts in this case, there were several elements of the duress defense that were missing. Specifically,
the immediacy element and the link between why he committed his actions and the supposed threats by his mother.
What's the theory behind the duress defense?
Is that individuals acting out of an unlawful threat of immediate death or immediate harm, and it's basically compelling or coercing them to commit this offense, and that, you know, there's no other safe avenue available to them.
Why does or does not suicide fall within the theory of that that principle?
Because if you start with the premise that it has to be an unlawful threat, which is court discussed in Washington, and if you determine that suicide is not...
But is unlawful part of your theory that you just stated in terms of duress?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the first...
And where's unlawful come from? Is it from the rule, for example?
It's not in the rule. It's not in RCM 916H, Your Honor, but it is in this court's holding in Washington. In that context, the government agrees it was different there. It was a natural force. It was an accused who didn't want to get a shot, a vaccine. However...
And is it your view that the theory of duress then does not apply to the context where you're feeling pressure because a third party is threatening suicide?
That's correct.
You can't feel duress from that?
You could feel moral and ethical duress. It would be a factor to consider in extenuation and mitigation, but it would not be a legal excuse as recognized under the RCM 916H. No, Your Honor.
Are we bound by the defense as defined 916?
You're not bound by it. It's obviously it's not law. It's a rule for court martial. This court has interpreted that. I would think that to some degree you're bound by the published precedent of this court that has addressed what duress is and the elements required. And you know, we would look to the language in Washington regarding the unlawful threat. Again, looking back at the facts of this case, even assuming taking as fact that you can accept that suicide is a threat necessary.
Counsel, you're asking us to adopt a new rule that the record establish a prima facie case for a defense. And traditionally, prima facie means that on its face, it is a good defense. Now, that's a significantly higher standard. So are you saying that all of the elements of the defense have to be shown in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, we are. And I think that's supported. If you look at the case law, obviously the government admits that there is no language precedent suggesting, quote-unquote, a prima facie case. However, and I looked at Philippe, Ollinger, and Garcia. In Garcia, there were two elements required for the mistake of fact as to consent defense. The accused in that case, to the plea colloquy, raised only the subjective belief that what he did was reasonable. No objective component. This court said, you know what, there's no possible defense, only the mere possibility.
Doesn't the military judge have to reject the plea at that point, then?
No, Your Honor. The military judge has to reject the plea only when statements either by the accused or other evidence before him or before her has raised conflict with the plea. That's inconsistent. In this case...
But if you raise a valid defense and meet all the elements of the defense, as you've just stated, how then can the military judge accept the plea?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. I thought you were asking it in a different context. Yes, once you've raised those elements, a prima facie case, again, taken at face value as is required in Lee, yes, the military judge at that point under Article 45 is required to reject the plea, or you ask further questions, and the accused would have to expressly disavow that.
So what you're arguing is that if evidence is raised during the providency inquiry that could lead to a possible defense, the military judge is under no obligation to make further inquiry. What we look at is the record, and if the record doesn't contain a prima facie case for a defense, then they haven't made it.
No, Your Honor. In that context, where if during the plea colloquy, in Philippe, it was during his unsworn statement, I believe. But once you've raised each element of a possible defense and you've made that prima facie case...
Well, wait a minute now. What's the difference between the elements of a possible defense and the elements of a defense? We're talking now, when you're arguing elements, that's a defense. This is a legal term.
Correct, Your Honor.
When we're talking about the possibility of a defense, that's when the individual says something that may give rise to a defense. And it seems to me that your argument would take all of that away.
No,
that,
Your Honor.
That there would be no longer any obligation. Is the military judge still under an obligation if the defendant raises a possibility of a defense? To clarify, to ask further questions?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. Once the accused has laid out the elements of a possible defense, taken at face value in context of the entire record, the military judge would have a duty under Article 45 to go back in and ask questions.
And so the prima facie rule would only apply then when we looked at it after the clarification was made.
In theory, it should apply at the time as well, because, again, you wouldn't have a possible defense for the military judge to clear up until a prima facie case was made. Again, prima facie, taken at face value, not rebutted, not considering any evidence by the government, just simply whether or not the evidence raised, taken at face value, would satisfy each element of a given defense. At that point, the military judge would have an obligation, Your Honor. Now, on appeal, when you're looking for substantial conflict, if that standard's going to have teeth, the lower court in this case erred because it assumed and presumed a fact that was not in the record. The lower court said, without even addressing this court's requirement for contextual analysis, the lower court said that because he feared for his mother's safety, he necessarily, there was some immediacy to the threat.
Counsel, if we go back to the Uniform Code of Military Justice in Article 45, what is the plain language of that article?
That a military judge has an obligation when taking a plea to ensure that there's an adequate basis in law and fact, or an adequate basis to accept that plea.
And if matters are presented that are inconsistent, is that the language?
Correct, Your Honor. When inconsistent, is required to either reject or further inquire.
Yeah. So in the legal question we're faced with, rather than all these contextual arguments and all that, aren't we simply, was this inconsistent with his plea?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if suicide is a defense, then he said, I did it because my mother was committing suicide. Isn't that inconsistent if suicide is a defense?
Absolutely, Your Honor. However, and that's the importance of this case, is if you look at the factual record, the context of the entire record, the appellee never says anything close to I did this because my mother was threatening to kill herself. He talks about the pressure that he felt. He talks about his mother's concern, mother's suicide ideations. There's no link between what his mother says. There's nothing to indicate that his mother said, steal this money or I kill myself. Nothing to say, get me money or I'll kill myself. Those two are not sufficiently linked. And so when you're looking at the elements that are missing in this case, similar to Olinger, there's no immediacy. The appellant committed these crimes over a five-month period. The way he dealt with this, Your Honors, was to go home, according to him, taking at face value in the unsworn statement, as this court must. He'd go home, he said, every week. Nothing about that indicates an immediacy. Not the time frame, not the threats, nothing in time, place, or manner. And if that element is going to have meaning, the appellate court below should have considered that, and they did not.
Okay, so it lacks immediacy?
Yes, Your Honor.
It lacks immediacy, and it lacks causation?
It lacks that there was a link between why he did what he did and any threats by his mother, and it also lacks that he had no alternative.
Well, I think that's what you're saying. You're saying that the threats by his mother, whatever they may have amounted to, there's no causal link between that and what he did.
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay.
And when you're viewing his unsworn statement, Senator Cox, as you said in Penister, and this court cited in Garcia, we should not overlook human nature and its tendency to rationalize why we do bad things.
Do we have to adopt the prima facie rule that you're urging in order for the government to prevail?
We request that you adopt it in order to clarify what is a mere possibility and a possible defense. But no, Your Honor, you do not have to adopt that. Not when you lack the immediacy.
So in this case, it's clear enough without the rule.
We can win, and we should win without the rule. However,
if we decide that suicide isn't part of the duress defense, that ends it, doesn't it?
No,
we don't have to get into any of this.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. If you decide the suicide...
Counsel, your time is up. You're allowed to respond to the question. Please fire away.
I'm done.
Yep. Would you like to summarize in 1 minute or less?
Briefly, Your Honor. Chief Judge, thank you. Your Honor, to answer your question, we would agree if this court finds a suicide cannot be the threat necessary, then absolutely the inquiry ends there. This court should then reverse the lower court and affirm the convictions. Notwithstanding that, the facts in the record here do not raise substantial conflict. That standard should have meaning, and the lower court below failed to adhere to that. And as a result, there was not substantial conflict with this plea.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellee, please.
May it please the court, Major Jeff Liebenguth and Captain Paul LeBlanc for the appellee, Midshipman Thomas Hayes. Today we ask this court to rule definitively that the duress defense can't emanate from a suicide threat. A plain reading of RCM 916H supports this ruling, as is the very purpose of the defense, which the Supreme Court concisely stated in Dixon. Otherwise, criminal conduct is excused where an accused is exposed to a threat or coercion that a person of reasonable moral strength would not be expected to resist.
How does this fall within the rule? How does this fall within the requirement of the rule that the person threatened be either the accused or an innocent third party?
Well, when you've applied this rule in the past, Your Honor, it's been a very contextual analysis. So that innocent aspect, First of all, it'd be very difficult for the conduct.
And I'm not interested in whether suicide is
understood,
unlawful under the laws of any particular state.
Understood.
I'm interested in the construction of the rule.
If it is an unlawful act, then it would be very difficult to find that his mother wasn't also an innocent person. But
if you parse the language, isn't the obvious intent to make it a threat to the actor, the allegedly criminal actor, or an innocent third party coming from the person from which it came?
No, Your Honor. The purpose, and it's a policy consideration that the rule is meant to
achieve. Well, now, wait a minute. You're talking policy. I'm talking the construction of the rule.
Understood, Your Honor. The plain reading of the rule would consider Midshipman Hayes' mother here an innocent person, Your Honor. The reason being that the very purpose of it is excused conduct where someone is feeling their mental state is such that they had to do this criminal act. That's what the Model Penal Code's choice of evils doctrine addresses.
Well, I'm not really interested in the Model Penal Code. I'm interested in the rule.
The plain reading of the rule, Your Honor, we think supports the duress defense here. And this court in Washington applied RCM 960 in a very contextual manner, in a very commonsensical manner.
Just to verify your answer to Judge Stuckey.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I understand correctly, he's asking you why the mother is or another innocent person. Is that correct?
Yes.
Characterization of your question?
Yes.
Without going outside that language, why is the mother in this case, putting aside what the facts are, but just assuming the mother threatening suicide, why is that or another innocent person?
It's the most difficult question for us to answer, Your Honor. And we think the answer is simply...
Counsel, I'm really having trouble hearing you.
It is the most difficult question for us to answer is why she would be an innocent person in this case.
Another innocent person,
yeah. Your Honor. And the answer what we would offer is that you'd have to look at it in a very contextual manner. In Washington, there the duress defense was raised by the accused because he refused a direct order to take the last anthrax vaccination. Now, that clearly falls under RCM 1916H. He feared for himself that he would die if he took this last dose of medication. The court said, no, it doesn't apply here because that's the very purpose of the military. We can't have military personnel whose job is to go and fight for its country and risk its lives to be ordered into these types of situations.
You're arguing by metaphor, but we still just want you to tell us in plain English why the mother was another innocent and a person.
Because if she's not an innocent person, Your Honor, the entire rule and its purpose collapses. And that's our best
No,
answer.
The entire rule does not collapse. That's wildly overdrawn. Well, you still have a third-party situation. You still have, you know, if there is a third party exercising duress on the appellant, that doesn't collapse.
Well, then alternatively, Your Honor, we would say that then we have to look to the mind of Midshipman Hayes. And what did he think in terms of another? Did he think she was an innocent person? And what effect did that have on his mental state when he conducted...
Isn't that a question of law? What constitutes another innocent person?
Well, it probably, yes, Your Honor. But
then what difference does it make what he thought?
I think in making the legal ruling, Your Honor, on whether she's an innocent person or not is dependent on the circumstances of the case, just like this court applied RCM 1916H and analyzed it in Washington.
But counsel, now when you're talking about the circumstances of the case or the contextual inquiry that you would like us to undertake, it sounds like you're saying that we look at that from a subjective standard.
This court has, Your Honor. It did exactly what it did in Washington.
So no matter how unreasonable, and I'm not talking about your particular client, but no matter how unreasonable someone's belief was that something terrible was going to happen if they didn't commit a crime, they would be entitled to the defense of duress?
Probably not in a contested case, no, Your Honor, no. I mean, you still have to meet that reasonable bar in order to get the instruction, and it'd be something for the members. But this is a guilty plea case. And in a guilty plea case, as this court talked to the government about, It's not about whether he hits all of the elements of the defense. It's a matter of simply whether he brings up an inconsistency. And
counsel, would you agree that there's nowhere in the record that your client said, I knew if I didn't do this, my mother would kill herself, or any words to that effect?
Not that specific, Your Honor.
Would you agree with my reading of the record that there's nothing that would explain why this, or would you agree that one of the hardest facts you have to overcome is that this behavior continued over a period of approximately 5 months?
Yes, Your Honor. And if the military judge had asked the questions, we would know the answer.
But can you see why the fact that happened over that period of time might lead the military judge not to ask the question? Might make it reasonable for him not to raise the question?
Perhaps, Your Honor. Yeah, we can see that. But this duress aspect of this case did not come out of the blue. This was the entire sentencing phase. That was the defense theme. And you find this information on it, even in his NCIS statement, talking about the pressures mother was giving him.
Counsel, why don't you review in the record before you complete Judge Ryan's question exactly what text or language or elements of the record you're relying on?
I would direct you to pages 77 and 78 of the Joint Appendix, Your Honor. Starting at page 77, he goes in about the middle of the page talking about how his mother was calling, crying, sobbing, telling him that she didn't want to live anymore. He talks about his father passing away and how his little brothers might lose their mother. He says, that's what led me to my first time taking an item and selling it. Then he talks about it, which is mere curiosity, which is somewhat inconsistent in itself with that statement. Then on page 78, the most specific, and we think the best statement in terms of raising this inconsistency, is where he says, I didn't know how to deal with somebody who's threatening to end their life or threatening to, not be there anymore. And that was enough. The reason this court...
Just to be clear, is that the sum total of what you believe was before the military judge that should have prompted him to inquire further?
We think it was huge, Your Honor, but then we'd also point to the mother's statement that came in sentencing, which is a joint appendix.
I don't have a stake in the answer. I just want to make sure I have the full menu.
That's the crux of it, yes, Your Honor. There's nowhere else to really direct the court, although obviously this was the theme throughout the defense sentencing phase. And the very reason this court has been vigilant and protecting against irregular guilty pleas is because it's understood or recognized that the military has a very coercive aspect to it. So
why wasn't the judge's 21, according to the government, but multiple questions to the appellant during the finding stage of the colloquy enough to resolve that?
Repeatedly,
the judge says, is there anything that made you do this? And the judge, I have some of them marked here, says things like, were there any circumstances which forced you to take this item? Why isn't that a good opportunity for the appellant to say, yes, this circumstance?
Well, it flips the whole rule upside down, Your Honor. I mean, it's the very point. That's what in evidence stands for, is that even though he went through the Providence inquiry, all the facts, he was gave all the facts necessary to make the plea provident, he then later says something inconsistent.
Well, counsel, I'd like to follow up on the Chief Judge's question.
Yes, sir.
And talk about our rule, the rule this court's established as to when a possible defense is raised. And both in Philippe and in Shaw, we said when, either during the plea inquiry or thereafter, in the absence of prior disavowals, circumstances rise a possible defense, a military judge has a duty. In this case, it seems that there were a number of prior disavowals that he said he was asked in every instance, were you coerced in any manner? And he said no. And so how do we get around that? And here on the record, there are disavowals of every offense.
Yes, Your Honor. And the way we get around it is when we apply this court's rule, it's certainly free to make a different rule. But under its rule, if he makes some inconsistency at any point, the military judge is required to go back in. And the reason for that, the reason this court's been vigilant against protecting against irregular pleas, is because of that coercive environment. We understand that he may have pled guilty, but then in a relaxed state, given an unsworn statement, he may say things that bring up a potential defense. And maybe he doesn't even know the defense exists. Maybe his defense counsel didn't discuss it.
But then what's the meaning of that rule? What's the meaning of that language? And I mean, I think it's a hard question. I don't know what the
agree,
meaning
and
of that
and
language
is. And this court is, as we put in our briefs, it's a contextual analysis. And this court can't make that rule clear. We know it when we see it based on the context of the case. And here the military judge just failed to recognize it.
Would you agree that his prior statements constituted a disavowal of the fact that he was coerced in any manner?
Yes, Your Honor. But it doesn't resolve the problem that he may not recognize that the duress defense even exists.
Well, I agree with that. But, I mean, our rules, as we've stated, our rule's the rule. So I'm wondering how you get around it.
If we go down that road, Your Honor, we really think you start to erode this court's prior precedent under Philippe, under Lee, where it doesn't even matter if it's credible or plausible. The question
is, it doesn't matter if it's credible or plausible. Well, now, doesn't that push us back into the mere possibility, which we disavowed? You know, in Prater,
we didn't read. Yes, Your Honor, we did not read Prater and Olinger Shaw to mean that Lee was overturned. If it is, then we may have
We've said that the mere possibility is not enough,
Your Honor.
And it sounds like you're arguing that the mere possibility ought to be enough,
Your Honor. Our distinction between a mere possibility and a possible defense is it's just a matter of names and labels. That is, this court could simply say that a possible defense was raised or it wasn't. Mere possibility.
Well, I asked that of the government. I said, what's the difference between a mere possibility and a possibility?
Right.
And I didn't get much of an answer, and I'm not getting much of an answer from you, except that they don't mean anything.
My answer is going to be better, Your Honor.
Let me have your better answer.
Counsel, you could just say it's like pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not. It's either possible or it's not possible. There's
exactly,
no such thing as a mere possibility.
That was better than what I was going to use. And that is what we think, because you either have a possible defense or you don't. And this is really what this the application of that rule is what this court has been doing. You either raised one or you didn't. And so the question is then, can duress defense emanate from a suicide threat?
Can't the same argument be made as to immediacy? Either it's immediate or it's not. And in this case, your client testified that this situation caused him many sleepless nights.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's tossing and turning and he's thinking about that. How does that meet the immediacy requirement?
Well, Your Honor, because each duress defense would probably apply to each different act here. That is, we don't know. Would it be available to the first time he stole it and the third and not the fifth and seventh?
Well, apparently, if he had many sleepless nights, it occurred a number of times after he talked to his mother.
And had the military judge made the inquiry, Your Honor, we would know more. In our reading of this court's precedent, the whole purpose for the military judge to be vigilant, that's this court's language, vigilant about pleas like this, is to go in not where you've actually raised all of the elements of the defense, but where you're saying something that suggests that, hey, there's something there before. Pleading guilty is not just is not an informal thing. You're giving up a lot of rights, and the only thing left, as this court has pointed out, is to determine his sentence.
How can it be immediate when it continued over 5 months? There are 10 specs.
Yeah.
He did it 10 times over 5 months. I mean, was she yelling at him every night, I'm going to commit suicide tonight. I don't think so. That's not in the record.
And the reason
is not. And he didn't give all the money to Mom. I'm not sure what the relevance of that is, but
it's not relevant, Your Honor. Yeah. We agree it's not relevant. And it may have been exactly.
I don't think he said it wasn't relevant, counsel. I think he said he wasn't sure what the relevance
Yeah, I said I'm not sure what the relevance of that is. But anyway,
yes,
you got a 5 month period. He pled to 10 specs, 10 specs times two, because it's two different charges. And he said every time, nobody forced me to do this. I did this of my own free will and accord, blah, blah, blah. Where's the element of immediacy at all?
Well, if I could answer the first part about him disavowing. We find that in every guilty plea, as far as I know. Every time you see, did anyone force
grant that. Now get to the immediacy.
So the immediacy, Your Honor, it may very well be that each time he stole something, gave it to his mother because of these phone calls, and it allayed his fears. At that time, she was in a little bit financial position. She was bubbly and more happy, and then she runs out
of money. But that hardly amounts to duress. Keeping mom happy with the proceeds of stolen government property is another thing entirely from preventing mom from committing suicide when she's under the immediate apprehension of committing suicide, leaving aside the question of suicide triggers the defense at all.
Maybe I was a little glib in saying that she was happy and bubbly on it. The point is that she's calling saying, I'm going to kill myself. I need money. He steals something. He sells it on eBay. He gives her the money.
She shuts up
for a while and comes back.
Okay, well then keeping mom quiet. Let's leave happy out of
it. Yes, sir.
Is cleaving keeping mom quiet duress?
Well, the point would be counsel, not that she just kept quiet, Your Honor,
please answer his question, but I have a follow-up
yes,
question.
Yes, Your Honor. But that she's no longer in a state of mind where, or he's no longer in a state of mind where he thinks she's going to commit suicide.
I think I know what you're saying. You're saying it was repeatedly triggered over a five-month period.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Judge Cox has a question.
Counsel, what is the genesis in criminal law of the line of defenses that a person can be excused from their criminal conduct if they're coerced, if they're under duress, if there's necessity? All of these things come under. And we've said in the Washington case, as I understand the case and your argument, that a military order cannot ever be excused by duress or fear for your life if you obey the order.
Yes, sir.
But this suicide is a novel question in military law, isn't it?
Agreed, Your Honor.
And the circuit courts have decided it. How have they decided it?
They're split. They're all over the place as well.
They're over as to whether suicide can be the necessary force to allow the excusal of criminal conduct, right?
The Seventh Circuit and Tony found that it could be, Your Honor.
Are we trying to, I guess my question back to the questions of the other judge, are we trying to squeeze another defense, a round defense, into the square hole of 916? Or does this constitute a separate and distinct analysis by the court? Under what circumstances could suicide of your mother, of your friend, of your commanding officer, of your buddy, back to Judge Baker's question, you know somebody's getting ready to commit suicide, can you leave your post to go save them?
If I understand the question correctly, I think, first, Your Honor, duress defense and necessity sprung from the common law initially. So, from the common law, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if RCM 916H, you find that it doesn't include the duress defense, springing from a suicide threat, then we do think the court can fashion a rule saying that that is an affirmative defense in the military. So I guess that's a way that if we can avoid getting wrangling over the innocent aspect, which we agree is kind of a complex question. And we simply left with this notion that it would be unseemly to have, you know, A, threaten to kill themselves, lest B, commit the most trivial of crimes, and B, is required to allow the death to occur, lest he be exposed to criminal prosecution without this defense being available. And that's certainly something we argue this court should not condone. And if it feels that this innocent aspect of RCM 916H precludes the duress defense springing
from... But you're falling into the trap of calling it the duress defense.
Oh, I see.
And then that brings into the elements in 916. I'm trying to ask if it's possible that suicide is another category, that given the facts and circumstances of a particular case, a reasonable person would disobey the law in order to prevent the suicide.
And my short answer is absolutely, Your Honor.
We don't have to call that duress,
you
do
don't
we?
Have to you call it necessity, justification, or so on.
Then if we slide off, as Judge Cox is doing, if we get off duress and into necessity, and I see your time is up,
but
please answer this question. If we get off duress and into necessity, doesn't necessity have to be, isn't that a matter for the legislature? Doesn't that have to be in the statute? Have we ever upheld a judge-made defense of necessity?
No, Your Honor, you have not.
Okay.
But I would just conclude on that answer with, the duress defense is not legislated either. RCN 916H comes from the president. So
right.
This court could certainly fashion that rule. And in the end, it really should. There's no principled reason, policy, legal, or otherwise, that the government can offer this court as to why the duress defense should not be available to circumstances.
No, you're getting into duress again.
Or any, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Lord, I don't
yeah I'm talking necessity. I'm not talking duress.
Any type of defense, this defense, there would not be a defense available to an accused under these circumstances.
Counsel, okay, your time is up. Do you have more questions?
No. I just want to understand. You're saying we should judicially construct this.
If that's what the court needs to do, because RCN 916H fines doesn't apply, then yes,
thank
sir.
You.
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
You said the circuits were split on this question. Have any of the circuits addressed this question directly or only by implication? And please indicate which circuit has decided what.
I can't answer that question very well, Your Honor. I don't know. The research I recall doing on the circuits was it seems to be more by implication than directly, but I could be wrong.
Which is
that.
Your best case in favor
Will
of
you
your
cite
position?
Tony,
and circuit. Which is the case that's least favorable to your position?
I don't think I cited the least favorable one, Your Honor, and I don't have it off the top of my head.
I'm sure the government will
I'm
provide
sure,
it
Honor.
To us. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from amicus Mr. Lepp.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Justin Lepp, appearing today as amicus curiae. To answer the question that Your Honor was just asking, only the Seventh Circuit has squarely addressed the question of whether suicide threats can form the basis of duress. No federal court of appeals has ever held to the contrary specifically. But to address a couple other questions that this panel has asked and answers that I think need clarification, the first is the construction of the text of RCM 916H. The rule makes available the duress defense when the accused's participation in the offense was caused by a reasonable apprehension, that's the apprehension of the accused, and what comes after that is a subordinate clause, starts with that. So we're describing...
Counsel, could you speak a little slower?
Sure,
a little more distinctly.
I apologize, Your Honor. The apprehension of the accused, that the accused or another being a person other than the accused, innocent person. So the rule makes the duress defense available whenever the accused has a reasonable apprehension that he or she or another person other than him or herself, will suffer immediate death or serious bodily injury. Midshipman Hayes' mother was an innocent person. She was not threatening any unlawful action other than himself, other than the defendant. So in this case, and in the case of suicide threats generally, they fall within the plain language.
Can't you just as easily construe another to mean, A, the accused, B, a third party innocent of any action, being acted on by yet another third party, namely the duressor? Isn't that an equally likely construction?
No, Your Honor, because the reasonable apprehension that clause describes is the reasonable apprehension of the defendant. So we're examining the rule from the point of view of the defendant the whole time. And so the words, another innocent person, are set off from the accused, are meant to distinguish the accused from
the
other.
Well, if the accused has a reasonable apprehension that third party number one will harm third party number two, who was otherwise innocent in the matter, doesn't that cover the language? If third party number one says, I'm going to kill your girlfriend tomorrow if you don't steal this stuff from the Navy tonight, and the guy says, okay, and goes out and steals it. I mean, isn't that equally comprehended by the language?
That does fit the rule, Your Honor, and that circumstance would certainly fit within the rule.
Okay.
But there's no reason to categorically exclude suicide threats or circumstances that involve only two people from the rule as it's written. Because as it's written, the rule only requires an accused and another innocent person. Those are only two people. Either two people or three people, the rule doesn't categorically bar one scenario.
Counsel, can I just clarify, or to be clear, you're only arguing issue three here, is that
That's
correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
So you're not here to argue the specifics of the plea colloquy. Could you, in plain English, tell us what the rationale behind the defense's arrest is?
Certainly, Your Honor. The defense of duress, like all justification defenses, is rooted in notions of fundamental fairness. It recognizes that an accused who has no opportunity, no fair opportunity to avoid acting unlawfully because of threatening conduct from some natural force or another human agency, because they lack...
That's plain English, a human agency thing? Yeah. That's how you talk at home around the dinner? Yeah.
That is actually how I talk at home, but I'm...
Okay.
If a person is under a threat and they cannot avoid acting unlawfully, they lack a fair opportunity to avoid that, then the law recognizes that they should be excused, that their criminal conduct...
Okay, thank you. Here's my next question. If you were hoping that we would review one particular case or one particular treatise or one particular whatever it is to inform ourselves on the theory behind duress, what would you ask us to read?
In Dixon v. United States, Your Honor, the Supreme Court decision, they lay out that rationale that I just listed, that the doctrine is rooted in the notion of fundamental fairness.
And in your view, that's the strongest statement of what the theory of duress is about?
The rationale, yes, Your Honor.
And in the case of Washington, the concept of unlawful comes in. Where does that come from? Now, I'm not asking you to try and figure out what we were saying and why, but where might that word come from, and what's the theory behind it?
The theory behind that, Your Honor, is that under certain circumstances, it makes sense to distinguish between lawful acts and unlawful acts. And specifically, in the military context, when an accused is charged with disobedience to a lawful order, as was the defendant in Washington, in that context, holding otherwise would set up a situation where a lawful order that puts a defendant in harm's way, as many lawful orders, of course, do, could be used as the basis for a justification defense when the defendant disobeys that order. That would be absurd. And so the court in Washington was justified in saying, no, only unlawful orders or only unlawful conduct can form the basis of duress when we're talking about disobedience. That doesn't mean that lawful threats can never form the basis of a justification defense for any violation of the UCMJ. In a case like this, where we're dealing with a more garden variety crime like theft, a crime that doesn't directly implicate military discipline or the core values of military service.
Wait a minute. A midshipman stealing from the Navy, a potential officer, someone who's already taken the oath and who steals military property repeatedly of substantial value over a lengthy period of time, and that doesn't implicate the core values of military service.
The effects of that conduct certainly does, Your Honor. That's correct. But the crime of theft in the abstract is not something that, if we recognize the justification defense, there's no way that an accused who is charged with theft could use disobedience to a lawful order as a reason for justifying their theft.
Are you now arguing necessity rather than the third issue? Or are you conflating necessity with third issue?
Either way, Your Honor, it doesn't matter too much for this argument, but because this court has never definitively held that necessity
right.
can never be recognized under the most extreme circumstances, I believe, is the language that it's used. And that also fits into the cases where this court has held that are those cases that deal with disobedience. It makes sense in that context to say that justification defenses should be very limited because we want people to obey lawful orders.
Okay. Is this that case, given the lack of immediacy in the extended period, or am I getting too far from three?
That's okay, Your Honor. The facts below were not fully and properly developed, so there could be additional facts that could lend themselves to fully...
Wait a minute. Oh, do we need to kick this back for a debate? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the military judge didn't find facts that the military judge should have found. There may be some facts out there.
Did the CCA?
No.
They didn't do it either.
I'm saying there may be some facts that could go to immediacy, but on the record right now, on the record right now, there aren't facts, I admit, that demonstrate that Midshipman Hayes will be able to fully and finally make out the defense of duress. But that doesn't mean this court shouldn't hold today that as a matter of law, suicide threats can, under at least some circumstances, form the basis of duress. And when we're talking about a crime that does not implicate the disobedience of lawful orders, those are the circumstances where the duress defense should be available. because under those circumstances, we're dealing with the basic underlying rationale of duress, that you have a coercive force acting on a defendant to cause the defendant to commit a crime that they would not have otherwise committed. And based on the law and the policy behind duress, there's no reason to categorically exclude those types of threats from the definition of duress.
And you're not arguing for a particular result and the application of the other two certified issues to the facts, but what you are trying to persuade the court to do is recognize that suicide under certain facts and circumstances may provide the catalyst for duress in the mind of a reasonable person.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it may be that the military judge failed to inquire further into the existence of duress because he was under the assumption that suicide could never form the basis of duress, which would further justify this court in stepping in and resolving that threshold question of law. That question is consistent with this court's precedents, with the broad definition of duress that this court laid out in Rockwood, with the plain language of Rule for Courts Martial 916H, and with the underlying purposes of the duress defense. Therefore, this court should find that suicide can, under at least some circumstances, form the basis of a duress defense, and at least it shouldn't be categorically excluded from the basis of duress. Unless Your Honor has any further questions.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument. We'll now hear government. Is there a rebuttal? Please.
Judge Stuckey, to better answer your question, the difference between a mere possibility and a possible defense would be when matter is raised in the record that forms each element of a possible defense, each element of a defense as raised, taken at face value.
Well, that's your prima facie argument.
That's correct, Your Honor, because that would actually rise to the level of being in substantial conflict with the plea.
Well, yeah, one would think so. Since, as Judge Erdman pointed out, it's a significant lifting of the standard.
Respectfully, the government's argument is that it would be consistent with Olinger, Garcia, and Philippe, where each time this court talked about whether or not each element of a given defense was met. In Garcia, there was one element missing, so there's no possible defense. In Philippe, each element, as this court said, the appellant, quote, lays out the elements of a possible defense. And in that situation, there was, in fact, a possible defense, and the conviction was set aside. In Olinger, where elements were missing of the duress defense, specifically the immediacy element and the nexus between why he did what he did, this court found there was no possible defense and amounted to at most a mere possibility. I mean, the appellee's counsel it didn't answer the question. What he said was, you should know when you see it. What the government's attempting to do is, in fact, clarify the standard. We're clear that there are two definitions, mere possibility and possible defense. What the government's asking this court to do is actually lay out when you meet that possible defense and make it easy for practitioners and judges below.
Counsel, the question I put to Amicus, what do you believe is the best statement of the theory behind the defense of duress that you would have us read if we were going to read one thing? Amicus, to refresh your recollection, Amicus cited to Dixon. Would you do the same, or would you point us in a different direction?
I would point you to RCM 916H itself. I mean, that's a rule for court martial, and it lays out the spirit of duress, which is someone's acting because there's reasonable apprehension of immediate death or immediate bodily injury. And those elements lay out why it's necessary. Additionally, the important factor to be included there is that it truly is your only option at that point. And I think another question that was asked...
Counsel, is that... I want you to be able to answer your question, but you are out of time at this point. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Very briefly, Your Honor, if I may.
Sure. Actually, answer Judge Ryan's question first.
Do you have a case that talks about, when they talk about immediacy of harm, that talks about what kind of a time frame it is that we're talking about for harm to be immediate or a threat to be immediate?
You're in the discussion of the RCM 916H, it says potentially the next day could be immediate if there's no opportunity to avoid it. I know that in Logan, this court found that there was no potential duress defense raised where the accused family was back in the States. He, I believe, was in Korea, and there was no indication as to the immediacy of the threat. So I don't know if there's a particular time frame, Your Honor, but it certainly wouldn't be over 5 months, where at best he's returning home, quote, every other week. That certainly wouldn't amount to an immediate threat. Judge Stuckey, if I may briefly, Your Honor, to answer the question as well about what relevance it has that he wasn't giving all the money to his mother. Actually, it's highly relevant to the case cited by the appellee, which is Tony. That Seventh Circuit case, which did say that duress could rise from a suicide threat.
Which is what?
Tony, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit case. And what that case said there is that you can have suicide be the threat necessary. However, it's not going to be a possible defense unless you had no other avenue of escape, and if you took other options or considered those. And you don't have those here. And Chief Judge, to answer your question briefly, there are other circuits which do, in fact, consider suicide indirectly, the 6th, the 9th, and the 10th. However, in all those cases, it's worth noting, they all say you don't raise that possible defense in the context at least of a contested case to get before a jury, and they use the exact language of prima facie.
And counsel, you've had a brief opportunity to be brief. Are you satisfied?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In light of the bonus time, do you have anything you'd like to add at this point, appellee?
Thank you, Your Honor. One point is there's a huge difference between a contested case where all of the elements are, I mean, the defense there has to bring them up and has to prove them in order at least show some evidence to get the instruction. This court has taken a totally different approach when it's a guilty plea context, which is what we have here.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, all counsel, including amicus. The case is now submitted. However, before we recess, I just would like to say we're going to recess, and then we'll resume in place and do a Q&A session, okay? So the court will stand in recess until further order of the court, which happens to be tomorrow at Scott Air Force Base. Could you please stand us in recess?
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.